You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey, music fans, welcome to Modern Musicology. My name is Alan, and here are my two co-hosts, Rob Levy.
Hey, hello.
And Stephanie Seymour.
Hello.
And this week we are joined by a very special guest. This is Mr. Craig Alvin. He's an award-winning audio engineer with a career spanning three decades, having worked with artists like Hanson, Little Big Town, Amy Grant, Vanessa Carlton, Will Hoag, Andrew Bell, and Brittany Howard. His work can be heard on the most recent Casey Musgraves albums, Golden Hour, which came out in 2018, Star-Crossed in 2021, and the brand new record, Deeper Well, which at the time that we're making this recording, just came out 2 days ago on March 15th, 2024. In February, he announced the opening of his newest venture, the Noble Steed Studios in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Mr. Alvin, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Glad to be here.
We're going to talk a lot about the studio and a lot about your career, but I'm curious to know what drew you to a career as a recording engineer in the first place.
Well, I used to play a lot in bands. And I grew up around a musical family. My dad was a gospel musician. But when I was, playing in bands, I played bass and I got tired of being on tour. So I started doing recording instead so I could still be around music and wouldn't have to be on tour.
Nice.
Where are you from? Did you grow up in Nashville or were you...
No, I grew up in Portland, Oregon, just on the outskirts of Portland, Oregon.
When did you move to Nashville? Because I know that you moved there and then you came to Alabama.
I lived for a brief time. I lived in Oklahoma City before I moved to Nashville. I was only there for a couple years. And then I moved to Nashville in 2007.
Where did you get your start as an engineer? Did you go to school? Did you just learn practically working in studios? What's your path from making that decision up to recording Grammy winning albums?
I started doing audio engineering back in high school for school choir and band, performances. Also for my dad, who was touring as a gospel musician, I would help with sound there. His band had mostly studio players in it. And I remember going to the studio a lot when I was a kid, just because there's nowhere else to go. So I would hang out there. But really, it was just kind of an organic thing. A lot of my friends were playing in bands, it was the 90s, early 90s, and alternative grunge music was starting to happen. And recording was still very expensive. Home recording was, not all that great back then. But I think the main thing for me was that when I started attending a college that had a radio room, that had a little recording set up. And I remember walking out of history class one day and a guy named John walked up to me and said, "Hey, do you know that they have a Neve here?" And a Neve is a very expensive high-end console. And I was like, "No way, show it to me." So we went over there and I went and asked if I could just use the room on the weekends. And they said yes, surprisingly. So I started recording bands while I was in college there. And the very first band that I recorded happened to be good enough that they got a record deal out of it. And so I helped make that record too.
What band was that? Just out of curiosity.
They were like a little Christian folk band called 5 o'clock People. But that was kind of right at that time when you had like Jars of Clay on the radio, when that whole like kind of Christian hippie alternative rock thing was was popular. And so that's what they were doing. And it was successful. So at least for the time, it was successful.
Man, I saw Jars of Clay at my college when they were just starting out. Like, they were nobodies yet. Yeah. That was a fun night.
Yeah, they're a good band.
How did you like make that transition then? So you're doing kind of the smaller things, and then did it just sort of gradually grow until that you were, you know, making larger and larger, you know, popularity albums, you know, or was it one thing that sort of sparked that transition?
For me, the big thing is just like when I decided that this is what I was going to do, I just haven't ever done anything else. I quit my job. You know, I was working at a church and at a restaurant, and I quit both of those and just decided that I was going to do recording because, I mean, I guess I was just dumb enough to think I could do it. So I did. and it just kind of worked out, you know, and for a lot of years, yeah, you do. I mean, the only way you learn to make records is you make a lot of really bad records.
Yeah.
And that's the only way you can do it. So you just keep practicing, you know, but I was kind of, I've always been obsessive about things. And before I was into recording, the thing I was really obsessive about was collecting guitar pedals, you know. And back then we didn't even call them vintage guitar pedals because everyone in the 80s who was a guitarist had moved over to these big digital rack systems. And the value of like the guitar pedals, like totally just tanked. Nobody wanted them.
Yeah, like people were using like the pod and stuff, right?
Yeah, but I was collecting like Electro Harmonix and Fox and, you know, all the weird off brands. And so I would drive around to music stores. Back then we had mom and pop music stores because Guitar Center didn't exist. And or at least it didn't exist in Portland. And I would drive around to those and pawn shops and just buy every guitar pedal I could find. And then when grunge music hit, those pedals just like the value of them went through the roof because that's what all the grunge bands were using. And I think the reason they were probably using them was because that's what they could afford. You know, they were just cheap and, you know, they kind of had that punk rock attitude of like, well, whatever you got, you know, just plug it in. If it makes a noise, great. And, right. But suddenly these pedals that I'd been picking up for $5 to $10 were worth, you know, $100 to $500. And, I wanted to open my first studio. And at the time, digital recording was not cheap. It was far more expensive than analog recording, but people were just starting to move into the ADATs and the DA88s had come out. And so I went and found a studio that was closing down that had a 2-inch 24 track and a console, and I needed $30,000 to buy them. So I used a kind of a music equipment broker guy that I knew up in Tacoma to sell all my pedals to all the bands up there. And I made over $30,000 doing that.
Holy
smokes. So I was able to buy all the stuff to open my first studio that way.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
Yeah. It's funny that really happened.
Do you have like any left at all from what you had, your original collection, or no?
No.
Oh.
No. I originally kept 8 that I really believed I wanted or needed. And then over time, the value of some of that stuff just keeps going up so much. But it just doesn't make sense to hold on to it, especially if you're not using it all the time. You know, sometimes just having cash in hand is like what you need. So, and those are, you know, assets that are pretty easy to sell. So I've eventually sold them all off, and I have a bunch more pedals now. I have a whole new pedal collection. So, yeah.
Well, speaking of opening a studio, just in February, this is just like a month and a half ago, basically, Noble Steed Studios, you opened in Muscle Shoals. And I'm curious to know, where do you begin when you want to open a new studio? Like, what's your list of must-haves? What are some of the things that you thought, okay, if I'm going to open a studio, this is what it's got to have. This is what it has to be.
So just so I understand the question, are you talking about like the location, or are you talking about just like the building or
equipment? Yeah.
Yeah. Equipment. Okay. I definitely believe in analog consoles and signal processing. I still use Pro Tools, but having a great like front end, you know, microphones, and, you know, having a console so you can route signals and combine signals and EQ signals. So you have inserts on every channel, and then, you know, having your appropriate outboard gear. I have kind of all the, you know, the Neve and Yuri and, you know, the Distressor compressors, DBX, and some Pultec type EQs and tube compressors, and then microphones. You know, I mean, if you talk to any recording engineer, they're going to tell you this is the essential stuff. One of the really interesting things that we came across is right over my shoulder here, this console. Nice. Back here, that is a Universal Audio 610 tube console from the 60s. And there, you wow. can't find them. They're, you know, I think there's probably fewer than a dozen on the planet. Like, wow. I know Neil Young has one.
Wow.
You can't find them. And Jason, who's my business partner and manager from Noble Steed, we were just driving around one day and we saw a garage sale and went in, and that thing was sitting there. So we negotiated a deal for it.
Oh my God.
And bought it.
That's yeah. incredible.
Yeah. And it's an original Muscle Shoals console. It came out of one of the old studios here. There were tons of studios out here. But that was a studio in Lexington, Alabama called Woodrich Studios. And that was wow. their console from like the 60s all the way up through the 80s.
Imagine how many That's people incredible. Recorded on that. Just that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds amazing. I've never heard anything like it.
Wow. So the publicist that reached out to us and sent us a press release, and one of the things that it said was that you have a Harrison Series 12 console, which was a board that was used to record albums by the Chicks and Randy Travis and a few other people.
Yeah.
How did you find that? How did you acquire it?
Well, I bought that back in 2007, and that's the one I'm leaning against right now. I bought that back in 2007, and you know, it as far as mixing consoles go, studio mixing consoles, I think it's the greatest mixing console ever made. And you know, the Harrison consoles, they're mainly known for their film consoles, but what a lot of people don't know is that some of the greatest albums of all time have been mixed on Harrison consoles, like all the Michael Jackson records. Mm. You know, Thriller was mixed on one of these.
Wow.
Sade, Steely Dan, you know, you go down the list of the albums where people go like, oh, that's one of the best albums of all time. And it's like, oh yeah, it's a Harrison. So they have a really great legacy, and they're still in business. SSL just bought them, but they have a new console out too that's based on, you know, the classic Harrison, you know, circuits, the Mike Prien EQ, which is beautiful. I still haven't gone up to the factory to see it yet. I'm really looking forward to that.
How did you and Jason get hooked up? I mean, how did you meet, and how did you come to the idea of becoming, you know, partners in the studio and everything?
I had my former manager was a guy named Rashawn, who was also a friend of Jason's. And Rashawn had a management business in New York that did music, you know, like people like myself. But he also started another business that was a tech business, managing like app developers and people like that. So he had to let the music side go because the tech side was growing so fast. And I was like, okay, I understand, but you know, what do I do? You know, do you know anyone I should call? And he was like, actually, you should call this guy Jason. And I just called him up, and like, you know, pretty much by the end of the conversation, we had, you know, I was going to be represented by him. Mm-hmm. And then that was in 2020, the first part of 2020. And, you know, a few months later, COVID hit, and we were just kind of looking at each other going like, well, you know, it's been fun, but this probably isn't going to work. But surprisingly, 2020 was a great year for me. And, you know, Nashville being what it is, it's a great town, but it our neighborhood got hit by the tornado.
Yes.
And then the whole city got hit with, I think it was a 37% property tax increase.
Oh my gosh.
And so we went, you know, maybe we need to look elsewhere. And we decided to look in the Shoals because it was still close to Nashville, you know, easy driving distance, but it's a music town. You know, there's the history of the music and the studios here is legendary. And so, you know, it doesn't seem like too far a stretch. Plus, I think it's a better story than just like, you know, oh, everything was going great in Nashville, so I stayed, you know. I think this is a more interesting story. And we came down here and found this building, and turns out property's on sale down here. It's about a 10th to Nashville. So we bought a building and decided to put the studio in it.
Do you think at a time when Nashville is just like crazy crowded and everyone's going to Nashville, that sort of maybe having a studio that's not based in like that kind of an environment sort of helps the artist and help you sort of put out a record that's really good, because you're not really like running around and it's not so like just frenetic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's a long history of, you know, studios that are kind of, you know, out of the way. People like studios that aren't in the city, you know, because first of all, they're a lot quieter. They're certainly more peaceful and you can focus. You know, one of the problems, if you're like, say you're a band and you're working on an album, you know, if you're in your hometown, you've constantly got your job and, you know, family and stuff like that. Everybody's like constantly trying to pull at you. And if you get out of all that and go somewhere a little bit remote, you can just focus. In fact, that's the whole reason why in 2019, I came down here with the band Hanson, and we worked over at Fame Studios, because, you know, they're dads and, you know, husbands, and they, you know, their offices are and studio are in the same building. And while they have a really nice studio, they're constantly being pulled out to go like into other meetings or to deal with the dog or whatnot, you know, where here we were able to go like, okay, we have 2 weeks. Let's just really focus.
Yes. It's definitely a good way to just focus.
Yeah.
And also I read you have a guest house basically that artists can stay. I don't know if they have to rent it or whatever, but you have a house that holds like 8 people that artists can stay
at. Yeah. Yeah. It's a nice place. It's about 4 blocks away and it's just, you know, available for a small fee extra, you know, most of the studios here, have that, you know, because most of the people coming here to make a record aren't from here. And it's always been that way, you know, ever since the 60s, you know, people were driving in or flying in and, you know, working and then leaving.
Yeah. And it's nice not to have to stay in like a hotel kind of environment. It's more like a house kind of situation where everybody can just chill out at night or whatever, or in the day if they're recording at night.
It's an easy stroll, like just, I think it's 4 blocks. Mm-hmm.
There was something else in the press release that was saying, that artists get a rebate of 30% if they work with, I think it's the Shoals Music Maker Program. Is that right? Or how does,
yes, can you tell us about that? Is, it's up to 30%. I think the benefits kick in at $5,000, and between 5 and 10, you get 10% back. And then 10 to 20,000, you get 20% back, and anything between 20,000 and 200,000, you get 30% back. So, and that's for all expenses related to the recording, including travel, food, you know, hotels, rentals, musicians, everything.
Wow.
So you just, what you do is you go to shoalsmusicmakers.com and you sign up beforehand, and you submit a budget, like It doesn't have to be perfect, but you have to fill out the paperwork and basically give them a general idea of how much you're going to be spending. And then you go and make the record and keep all your receipts. Mm-hmm. And then you're done with the record, you turn all your receipts in. And then when the album comes out, they cut you a check.
That's so great.
They have millions of dollars to give away, and we need them to, because, you know, if we don't get people using this program, then it goes away. But I mean, it's a lot of money to get back. You know,
it's a lot of money to get back. I know,
would be great, but like up to 30%. Yeah, I know. Incredible. Yeah.
Again, from the press release, I'm going to read this quote that was part of that release. It says, "This dynamic partnership brings together a wealth of talent and experience that promises to redefine the music production landscape." Now, I love the boldness of that statement. I'm just curious to know, talk a little bit about what you and Jason plan to bring to the industry and what you think is going to set Noble Steed apart from whatever else is happening in that area or nationally.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I mean, there's a lot of great studios in this area, and we're just glad to be part of that community. Mm-hmm. One of the nice things about this community is that we are all friends, and if I need something, I know that I can call, you know, I can call Rodney over at Fame, or I can call Jimmy across the street at the Nut House, and they'll help me out. And we really do enjoy being part of a community that, you know, mm-hmm. like we trust each other. So that's nice. It's also, you know, it's great that it's less expensive here. The studios are less expensive, but people aren't just looking for a deal. I really believe that that different places have different sounds.
Yeah.
So when you think of a record that's made in Los Angeles, it's very different than you would think of a record made in London or Memphis. Mm. You know, a Nashville record is very different than a Muscle Shoals record. And I don't know what it is, but the people who come down here to record, they all instantly get it. They know what that is. And so I don't know. It's so much that we're trying to bring something new. It's that we wanted to participate in something that's here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we want to offer, like a more diverse, you know, studio experience here. Because again, there's plenty of great studios and plenty of great people. We just wanted to be a part of it. And also it was, it's a lot more cost effective to operate here. So for us, and also for the people that come here to record. So, I think for us, it was just like, man, this place is cool. Let's see if we can, you know, get on board and help out.
So, I'm going to ask probably the dumbest question ever, but I think it'll help our listeners. Walk us through what an engineer does on a record. And how is that different from, say, a producer in the studio? I know it's a really basic question, but I know when I was prepping for this, a lot of people said, oh, ask them what an engineer does, because it always seems like they're always, each one does something different.
So this is one of those kind of blurry lines.
Okay.
So there are a lot of producers who are producer engineers. There are a lot of producers who don't engineer at all, like Rick Rubin. He doesn't know anything about this stuff. And whereas engineers are typically the guys who are running around setting up microphones, running the board, running the computer, making choices about, you know, things like mic placement and, you know, where is the guitar amp going to be? And they're working with the musicians to try and capture a sound that, you know, is good and that tells the story of the song. A producer can do all those things, but a producer is more in charge of the project as a whole, like over the whole project, mm-hmm. where they're deciding which musicians to hire, which studio to hire, which engineer to hire, which songs to record, you know, and working with the artist more on that level. A lot of producers choose to play too. but you know, engineering is and producing, there's a lot of overlap there. So it's kind of, it is hard to define, because I know a lot of engineer producers who really don't play any music. Like I played music. I was a music theory major in college, but I don't play music anymore. You know, cause I'm too busy doing this, and this is actually what I like doing. I like engineering. So I'd rather be on, you know, this side of it. And, you know, I understand music. I understand the language of music. I hear it. I know what I'm hearing, but yeah. So the answer is I hope even muddier now.
It's a gray line.
Exactly. Kind of what I thought. How then, because you're a musician too, I'm sure that your opinions on this are stronger than the more genteel folks in the studios. How do you handle an artist in a studio where you know that the take you just recorded as the engineer with your music gear and your music background is better than the take they want to use, or you have an idea on how to improve that? How do you sort of handle that relationship as being going from like creator to like overlord of the proceedings, right? How do you sort of interject yourself into those conversations, and then how do they generally go? Are they generally like weird and awkward, or you just generally always get your way, or how does that kind of go?
No. It doesn't have to be awkward, and I am very anti-authoritarian. Yeah. That's my Quaker roots. I just don't, I don't like to assert things too much. So I feel like time usually, if you just give it time, especially if you just give it a day, like don't like, if I think that, you know, take three was the one and the artist thinks that take four was the one, they're probably not all that different anyway. So there's nothing to argue about. Mm-hmm. If they like take four, you know, we'll just use take four.
Yeah.
It's not the end of the world, you know?
Yeah.
Now, you know, there are times when I will like go, hey, I really think there's something you need to consider, but I find that if you give it a little bit of time and perspective, you know, the one of the problems we have with music and that musicians have, is that as we're listening to it for the first time, or as we're performing it, we're attaching an emotion to it. And that emotion, while our emotions are valid, they're not always accurate, you know? And so you sometimes just have to allow a little bit of time for that emotion to fade so that people can be objective.
That's good advice.
But in the end, you know, with these kinds of things, I go by improv rules. I try to say yes and.
Yeah.
And move on.
Yeah, that's good advice. Very good advice, actually. I did a 3D tour of your studio on your website, which, by the way, anyone should do that. And it's, first of all, it's a beautiful, beautifully laid out studio, very pristine looking, and it just seems like a beautiful environment to record in. But I sort of have a geeky tech question here, because I went into 3D drum room and looked at, maybe this was just the picture, but do you employ the Glyn Johns method of recording with the three mics only? Or, because I saw the two kind of above the kit, but then I didn't see the one on the, you know, the bass drum, but. Does that depend?
The mics were mostly torn down on the drums because, as you know, for video, mic cords and stands are ugly.
Yeah.
And so I was just trying to be tidy. But I do use what I call a modified Glyn Johns technique, where, and if for people who don't know, the Glyn Johns technique is a three mic technique. And basically you have a mic that's an overhead. It's generally kind of over the hi-hat snare area facing down. And then another one facing at the snare, but usually from over the top of the floor tom. Mm-hmm. And then there's usually a kick drum microphone. Or a front mic out front, whatever. So I tend to use a similar technique, although I don't have my overhead mic facing over the top of the floor tom. I have it up a little bit higher usually to try and get a better picture of the ride, but I still face it at the snare drum. And I will measure that so that the center of the snare drum is the same distance for both overhead mics. So that way I have a strong center image that's in phase for the snare drum.
Okay, cool. Yeah, my husband started using that technique after, I mean, we would just be usually miking the each drum or whatever, but it ends up sounding so much better, I think, when it's simpler and bigger, you know?
I agree. You have to be careful with all the spot mics, you know?
Yeah, especially drums.
Yeah, because, I mean, while, you know, I feel like I've done a good job of developing technique and, you know, mic choices and placement and all that to where I can do the thing now where I can set up 14 mics on a drum kit and it will sound good,
yeah.
You know? But I also, in my philosophy, you should be able to grab any one or two of the, you know, three mics and find something that works.
Yeah.
You know? So like, I think my overheads and my kick drum mic should be a complete picture together, you know, and if you want to add in the snare, that'll make it possibly more complete,
mm-hmm.
or the hi-hat or either tom mic or various room mics or trick mics, you should be able to, you know, add those in, but really, if you want to, you should just be able to take the one mono mic and get a full drum kit out of it,
mm-hmm.
you know. That's I'm always thinking that way. I'm not thinking like when I think I'm miking the overheads, I'm not thinking I'm miking the cymbals. I'm thinking I'm miking the whole drum kit, full range.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank you. I just was so curious when I saw that picture.
Well, since we're talking about in the studio, I want to talk about Casey's new album, Casey Musgraves. The new album, Deeper Well, just came out. As we're recording a couple of days ago, as this episode comes out and people hear it, the album will have been out for a week. Can you talk a little bit about the recording of that album? What are some of your experiences in the studio as this album was being made?
First of all, I'm really not sure. I know that I did work on the record, and I'm not sure which songs I worked on. You'll find that after being in the studio for so long, I just have this thing where I can't remember song names at all to save my life. Like my brain, that part of my brain just went, okay, I'm broken now. And I don't remember song titles. We did do a few different sessions at different studios. And I think on the third week in, I was driving to the studio and I just suddenly realized that I was getting really sick. And so I called them up and said, hey, I don't want to come in because I know I'm getting sick. So I went home knowing that, like, oh, this is a bummer. You know, they're probably going to have to find someone else to finish. So I went home and I literally laid in bed for a month. I was so ill. And so I didn't get to finish the record, but I did get to start it. I just don't know, like, what they did.
Wow.
So
wow.
I haven't had a chance to go listen to the whole thing yet. I have heard Deeper Well and the song's beautiful. But you know, that was a while ago that happened. And honestly, I just like, it was a big bummer because, you know, I'd done the previous two records with them and I love working with that crew. They're some of my favorite people in the world, you know?
Mm.
So it was a bummer to not be able to finish.
Totally. With them.
But you know, things happen. So,
well, there is something that I wanted to ask you about, and this goes back to the previous album. So two albums back, Golden Hour was a big winner at the 2019 Grammys, mm-hmm. and it took home not only the country album of the year, but album of the year,
which is
huge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm most curious about though is the following album in 2021, Starcrossed, the Grammys removed that album from the country categories because they felt that while there were a few country leaning songs, they didn't consider the album as a whole to be country enough. And then mm-hmm. Cindy Mabe, the president of Universal Music Group Nashville, wrote a response that sort of blasted the Grammys for that decision. Do you remember that scenario? And what did you think about that decision of the Grammys and Universal's response to it?
Hmm. I mean, to be honest, I don't care what Universal says. That's all like politics, and they're a huge music company. But I do think that there was like, she is certainly moving more in a pop direction. And when we were working on that record, the influences that we were drawing on were definitely more from the pop, R&B and rap world. So it doesn't necessarily surprise me, but one thing I am really, really tired of are the country music gatekeepers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, who think that they get to define what country music is, when really music is kind of a party and we're all invited. And, you know, if you, I mean, Casey is as country as they get when it comes to like her background, you know, and the music that she writes and the themes and all that, that she talks about, like it's all country music has always been pushing forward. There was a time when you couldn't use drums in country music, you know? And there've been all kinds of rules, and this new Beyonce's single really had, I think, a lot of people saying some particularly stupid things mm-hmm. about what is country, what is not country. I don't know. And I am tired of that debate. I think that, you know, was Star-Crossed a country record? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wasn't thinking about it that way. I was trying to help some people that I know make the best record that they could make at that moment. And right. If it wasn't country enough, that's fine. But to take an artist like Casey and to kind of ban her from the country music side of the awards, I think that's, you know, mm-hmm. that's just silly.
Yeah.
That's just silly. She's won every single award possible in that, you know, in that genre. Mm-hmm. And maybe she makes a record that's a little bit more pop sounding. And then next time.
Yeah.
She might make a country record, you know, whatever. Right. I don't even know what that means. So I have a pretty good guess, but I don't know.
Right. When I listen to the three most recent albums, I don't hear anything that's such a drastic stylistic shift mm-hmm. that it would require her to be removed from a, you know, the whole thing about category, as you say, gatekeeping is bizarre to me. I mean, the three most recent albums
mainly old white guys, really well. So surprised.
Well, yeah.
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 Yeah. I mean, I sort of, in a way, for an award and for a category, I guess they have to somehow in their minds.
Yeah.
But still, maybe that needs to change too. So.
You know, I mean, the Grammys thing, it's complex. Yeah. It's always changing.
Yeah.
I do think that they're trying to do their best. And I do think that sometimes they don't do their best, but they are trying to do their best.
Yeah. Like most award shows, it's exactly. And they're evolving and, you know.
Yeah. I'm thankful for the progress that I see mm-hmm. and I would like to see more.
Yeah.
So a couple of weeks ago, Casey was on Saturday Night Live and debuted the two new songs, Deeper Well and Too Good to Be True. Did you catch that? Did you see the performance?
I saw the Deeper Well performance.
Mm-hmm. It was really good.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that on SNL, one week you'll have a rap artist and the next week you'll have, you know, the Foo Fighters. And then you might get Casey doing these two very quiet, very introspective, you know, very folky acoustic songs. And I love that, the blend of styles that you get from that show.
I mean, that's really, for musicians, that show, has introduced us to so much great music.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think especially if you're coming up in the 90s, that was kind of that was their kind of golden era of being able to like introduce artists that were important and give them a stage, a platform. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, I don't know. I don't think anyone watches TV. I don't think anyone listens to radio. So I don't know where people I mean, are they TikTok seems to be the place, you know, which you know,
and Saturday Night Live is really made now to be a series of reels that you discover on YouTube the next day or TikTok or whatever. No, very few people watch the entire show live start to finish. Yeah. I do every week.
Yeah, I watch it
but
too.
I've been doing it since season two. So
yeah. I don't stay up that late on Saturdays anymore.
Unless you're in the studio and there's some band that wants to really record at midnight.
Yeah. Typically that doesn't happen as much anymore.
Yeah.
So do you approach your job differently depending on the genre that you're recording? Is it different going into the studio with Casey Musgraves than it would be a rock band or something like that?
Sure. My role on a session like one with Casey is I'm usually, that's one where I know everyone in the room and I'm trying to just accommodate whatever they're, you know, whatever they're doing. So I'll listen to what they're doing and try and help them find a sound, you know, or a feeling or, you know, set up like, so they're comfortable. Mm-hmm. For me, that's a more, kind of relaxed thing where if I'm going in with a band or with like on a Nashville session, you know, things are very different with a lot of bands, especially younger bands. I'm doing a lot more coaching.
Yeah.
And you know, kind of helping them figure out how, especially if they don't have that experience recording, they don't know that you just can't bash the crash cymbal all the way through the chorus every time without wearing out your listener. So I have to like share this news with them.
That's
you
right.
know, in a way that they'll be receptive. They just don't know that. It sounds great in the garage. Why wouldn't it sound great in the studio? You know, and they look at the engineer like he's an idiot if he can't do that. It's like, well, you know, sorry, guys. But, you know, it's a little different every time. I mean, obviously with different genres, on a bluegrass record, I'm going to approach things very different than I am on a metal record. Although I haven't done a metal record in a long time and I miss those things. Mm-hmm. They were fun because everything sounded like, you know, Godzilla was crushing Tokyo. You know, it's like just huge monster sounds all the time. Really fun to work with. But bluegrass is different. You know, jazz is different. I used to do a lot of in Portland, I did a lot of more string sessions and symphonic sessions or, you know, sessions where we had choirs, stuff like that. I don't get to do that much, you know, much anymore. There was about a year and a half where I was like the world's leading expert on African marimba bands.
Wow.
I did tons of those records for some reason.
Wow.
Because I did one that went, you know, that became very popular in that world. So I think I had like in 1 year I had like 14 different marimba bands come to me.
You got a lot of referrals from it or whatever, right?
Yeah, and it's really fun music. You know, it's dance music. So, but it's all done live. It's all very, you know, it's all percussion instruments. So
yeah,
that, you know, but yeah, you just do different things. And if you're an engineer and you know how music works,
is there any art, I mean, you've worked with so many artists in so many different genres, really. Is there any like dream one or two artists that you really, really want to work with that you haven't yet?
Huh. You know, I've been asked this question so many times and it always trips me up.
Sorry to trip you up. Okay.
You don't have to answer. For me, if I'm working with people that are, you know, that are having a good time and are sincere about what they're doing, you know, and they've done the hard work of like being ready when they show up, then that's a great day. I'm just going to love it. You know, even if no one ever hears it, I'm going to love it.
Yeah. You know? Makes everything obviously run smoother and it's more, it's just more fun experience. I get that.
Mm-hmm.
The publicist that contacted us tipped me off to tell me that you are a big Yacht Rock fan.
Yes.
Who are some of your favorite artists?
Oh man. I don't know if you guys remember, but sometime like in the late 80s through the 90s into the 2000s, everybody forgot that this genre of music existed. Like, like nobody knew who Firefall was. It was so uncool to say you were a Steely Dan fan.
I know.
Like, that was a joke. Like, remember, like, when it was not cool to listen to the Eagles?
Oh, yeah.
And,
oh, yeah.
You know, like, you would actually, like, be, like, kicked out of parties, for liking the Eagles. There was this period where suddenly this whole genre of music was, like, completely hated. And then... I remember, okay, let's talk about the future of the past here. Mm-hmm. Sometime when the internet was, you know, sort of in its newer stages, in the, like, MySpace, Flying Toasters, Strong Bad Email phase, mm-hmm. YouTube came out, and there was a series called Yacht Rock. Did you guys ever see that? Yeah. Okay. It's interesting because I believe that's where the term yacht rock comes from, was they named it that. And I watched it and I suddenly remembered all this music that I grew up on, you know, Christopher Cross.
Oh my God.
And yes. The Doobie Brothers, you know, Michael McDonald, Kenny Loggins, Hall & Oates. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was hilarious. And one day I was in a session and I was in Oklahoma City. And this drummer comes in, his name is Tris, and he plays for Chicago. And, you know, I'm like, we're talking about, like, you know, I don't know, Chicago stuff and, you know, other music that we like, Toto and whatnot. And I was like, oh man, have you seen Yacht Rock? Mm-hmm. And he's like, no. So I played him the first episode in the studio and he was just falling out of his chair and he got done and he was like, you don't realize, like, that's really accurate. Like, they wrote that song in my living room. I was there. That's really what happened. And, and I wondered if he was like kind of, you know, just saying that, but I just watched an interview with Michael McDonald, who's like, yeah, I don't know who it was that made that show, but they knew some things. Like, it's accurate.
Wow.
Wow.
So, like, they got a lot of the details right. You know, and obviously some of the things, like, where I think it's John Oates is, like, the villain. And everybody thinks that's funny because he's actually supposed to be, like, one of the nicest men in the music business. But he's, like, the villain, and he's, like, constantly doing, like, karate kicks and calling people names, and, you know, he has, like, the cheesy mustache, and it's pretty funny. But, yeah, so that's when I was like, man, I gotta start listening to that music again. What was it? You know, because I'd heard it on the school bus when I was growing up every day, you know? I heard, like, Reminiscing or,
oh my God, you hear it on the radio every day. It was the soundtrack when you were
Baker Street, you know, mm-hmm. Like, I just, that is burned into my brain. And to have gone for, you know, a couple decades without hearing it, it sort of felt like visiting an old friend. So I went home and my wife and I, like, we were laughing about it and making a playlist. And then, we went into, like, our local, like, we lived in East Nashville, and our local kind of bar, pool hall place where we would go hang out was a place called Edgefield, and it was huge, but very friendly. It was like East Nashville's living room, you know, and it had one of those jukeboxes where you could just, like, you know, buy stuff on your phone and put on. So we started as a joke, like, putting in all these yacht rock songs. And at first, like, people would get so mad because they'd be like, who the hell is playing this? You know, they would get really, really angry. But then what we noticed was that over the next year, everyone started playing it.
Yeah.
And then it was, like, all they played for quite a while. So it was exciting. And, like, favorite bands, you know, Ambrosia, Steely Dan, Firefall, I've already mentioned them. You know, Seals and Crofts, like, there were so many great ones. 10cc.
Oh yeah.
You know, there were so many great ones. And And so I really started thinking about this genre because, you know, you also had like Toto and Fleetwood Mac, and like we're talking huge household names.
Right.
And like somehow this music that is so different than pop music is today, like really has been making a comeback into popular culture again. And I'm excited to see it making a comeback because personally, I love it. It's a different thing.
It is.
That was the radio landscape.
Yep.
Growing up 100%. For me in the '70s, that was what you heard on top 40 radio. That was all of it.
Isn't it nuts how like when you, so you said like, you know, you didn't hear those songs for like 20 years or whatever. I went to a yacht rock show with my friends. Like I was like, okay, I'll go. It was like 4 years ago. Whatever. And I remembered every single word to every song. Like it's just like, because it's in there in your brain. You heard it so many times.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, really fun. And I think as a genre though, it's interesting because like, if you listen to pop music now, like melodies are predominantly, I'm going to go music nerd here. But they're predominantly like major pentatonic. They don't go outside that at all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And back then the harmony was so much more complex.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A lot of it was like in like the Dorian mode or Mixolydian mode, which is like, they feel kind of like not settled, you know, like they mm-hmm. don't ever have a home. It's not, you know, diatonic or Bach traditional harmony. Mm-hmm. It is this different thing with lots of seven and yes. nine chords,
yes.
you know, or 11s. Mm-hmm. Did you know that there's a yacht rock chord?
What is that chord?
Oh, really?
Every genre of music has its thing, you know, that it's kind of known for. But there is a chord that is exclusively a yacht rock chord. And it's called a mu chord or a mu chord, depending. And it was created by Steely Dan.
Oh.
Oh, okay.
That makes sense. You want to know what it is?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, I'm prepared.
Yay! We're gonna get an example here. Oh my God, look at that.
So awesome. Oh, you guys, this is a JMR toy piano.
How cute.
Do you know that there's a yacht rock song that features a JMR toy piano? Let me see if I can play it here. Oh, I have to play it right. Did you hear it?
Oh, yeah, I know that.
Yeah.
Summer Dreams.
Yeah, that's it.
Anyway.
Oh, yeah.
If you listen to it, there's a horn part, but there's a JMR toy piano playing in the background with it. So you have to go listen to that. Summer Breeze.
Summer Breeze yep. makes me feel fine.
Yeah. So if you want to play the mu chord, so you have your major triad, the C, like C, E, G
mm-hmm.
here. Now, if you add the nine, which is the D, that's a mu chord. Essentially, except they take the third, which is the E, and they drop it down an octave.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Huh.
That's a mu chord.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
And it's like this weird floating chord that kind of goes nowhere.
Nice.
So.
Man, I love that.
Yeah. It just kind of like, it has that feel of that harmony of like, everything just kind of is easy. It's like we're not moving anywhere too fast, you know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's my JMR piano.
I love that.
Well,
that's the first time for the podcast, eh?
That's what I was gonna say. This might be the first time we've actually earned the title musicology. So we appreciate that very much.
Yeah. Sorry for being a nerd, but I was a music nerd in college.
I love this stuff. There's a whole bunch of YouTube channels that I follow that all they do is talk about tonality, and I just love it. Yeah. I eat it up.
Thank God for Rick Beato.
I love
He's
that
made it
guy,
okay
man.
To talk about this stuff again.
Yeah, exactly. I watch him all the time.
Yeah.
I know, because when I first heard your name, I knew I'd seen you somewhere before, And I realized that I saw you once on a Grammys pre-show thing.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering, like, what's it like to go to the Grammys? And sort of what's the process? Do you just show up and walk in? Do you have to show an invitation? How does this work? Like, what is it like to actually go to the Grammys? And like,
well, first of all, it's like the Grammys is not just one night. It's an entire like week.
Yeah.
And if you ever get to go, you got to go for the whole week. It's really, really fun. You will be exhausted. Do your liver stretches. And then go to the parties. It's really, really fun. You show up and they have like a place where you can check in and get your credentials and tickets and all that. And then, you know, you have the whole thing where you rent a car and then they drop you off at the red carpet and you walk in and they take your picture. That's not really my thing. I have a funny story at the Grammys if you guys want to hear it.
Yes,
of course.
All of the production crews are sitting in one area and all the album of the year. And so on one side of me was Brandi Carlile's people. They were wonderful. Yeah. And on the other side was Post Malone's people. And one of the guys, Post Malone, of course, had like 14 producers or something like that. And one of them was sitting right next to my wife. And he was a young kid. And we were just talking to him. He was super nice. And just thrilled to be there. And they go to commercial breaks, and you know, the Grammys are live. So they go to a commercial break and they start playing a performance of Paul McCartney from the year before up on a screen. And this kid looks at us and goes, "Who's that?"
Oh, no, I knew it. Oh.
And we're like, "That's Paul McCartney." And he's like, "Oh." And we're like, "Yeah, you know, like, he was a Beatle, like the Beatles." He was like, "Oh, okay, the Beatles, yeah." And then he turns and goes, "Who sang for the Beatles?" And we're like, "Well, they all sang, but maybe you're thinking of John Lennon." And he's like, "John Lennon, I think that's it. And then he goes, picks up his phone, Google, John Lennon got shot.
Oh my God.
Oh no.
Oh no.
Oh my gosh.
This guy's up for album of the year.
Oh wow.
Like, yeah, that happened a while ago, buddy.
Yeah, really.
Wow. Oh man.
That is so funny.
I feel like, okay, we're all right. I know we're of a certain age, but like, doesn't everyone know?
No.
Even if you're 20, I guess not. I don't know.
No. The kids are all wrong. Remember that.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much, Mr. Alvin, for joining us. We really enjoyed this discussion with you, and it's been so much fun.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Studio's awesome. I want to come down there.
Come on.
That's right.
We have a guest house.
Really? I'll be there before Labor Day weekend.
Perfect.
Yeah.
We will post the link to the website, and we encourage people to go and check it out, and especially to do the 3D walkthrough. So you get to know the studio and the area, and we wish you lots of fortunes with this thing. I hope it's a huge success. Thanks so much once again.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Thank you so much. It was great meeting you.
Attention, people of Earth. Looking for a way to kill half an hour every week?
Try the Flopcast. It's a silly podcast about cartoons, music, comics, movies, obscure pop culture from the 70s and 80s, and chickens.
Join us. Bring coffee.
We're on the ESO Network.
And we're at flopcast.net.
So we will be back next week. With a show, I'll just say that. And until then, Stephanie, why don't you kick us off with where people can find you?
You can find me on Facebook at Stephanie Seymour Music. You can find me on Instagram at @their_r_birds. And I have a website, therearebirds.com. And you can find me on Bandcamp under my name, Stephanie Seymour. And of course, on all these streaming platforms like Spotify and stuff like that.
All right, Anthony.
You can also find me on the Watchers in the Fourth Dimension podcast, watching our way through all of Doctor Who from 1963 until now. We are on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and all of those other places wherever you like to get your podcasts. And you can also follow us on social media at Watchers4D on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or X, or whatever the fuck it's called this week.
Right.
And you can also find me personally on Instagram at EnglishmanInATL.
Rob, how about you?
So you can find me on Facebook or the Twitter X planetary mess that is. Also on Post under my name. And you can find me on the radio on Wednesday nights on KDHX 88.1 FM in St. Louis. Streaming at KDHX.org. So you can listen to that on the archive stream whenever you want. It's there for you to listen to whenever. Also, I host a show on Louder Than War Radio on Monday nights from 6 to 8 Greenwich Mean Time. And then that's 1 to 3 Eastern, 12 to 2 Central. It's called Antics. You can listen to that there. And I'm also on the Weekend Justice podcast for IndieCoffee.com.
All right. And I've got a website that catches all of my nonsense in one place, and that is Cosmic Creative. CozMicCreative.com. You can find my books. You can find my podcasts. And I don't know, maybe I'll put out a coloring book and you can find that there too. I don't know. So we will be back soon. Hope you'll stick around with us. Until then, take care. Keep rocking on. And we'll see you soon.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping at the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.